So nice to have you back, Scott, on this podcast.
Good to be here.
Yeah. And let's get started with what's going on right now between Hezbollah and Israel. We have heard about the pager bombings in Lebanon, and it seems that the ambassador, Iranian ambassador to Lebanon, was injured by this attack. And on the other hand, the Israelis hard supported that Israelis are just expecting that Hezbollah is going to attack them in the coming hours, in a few hours. How do you see the situation right now between these two?
Well, I mean, what does anybody expect? This is war. It may be low intensity, it may be hybrid, but it's war. And the purpose of war is to inflict harm on your enemies. Israel launched an attack in Beirut that killed a senior Hezbollah commander. Hezbollah retaliated by striking Unit 8200 headquarters, reportedly killing the 8200 commander and killing dozens of Israeli intelligence personnel, wounding dozens more. And this appears to be a retaliation by Unit 8200, Israel's, cyber warfare unit. Buy better pagers. I mean, it's war. It doesn't matter whose side you're on. This is part of what hybrid war looks like. What did Hezbollah think was going to happen? That Israel was going to roll back and just take it? What does Israel now think is going to happen? That Hezbollah is just going to absorb 1,500 casualties? Because that's the number that's coming out now. What did Iran think? Buy better pagers. I mean, I'm sorry. Now that this in 1996, Israel put a small amount of RDX high explosives into a cell phone that had gotten to the hands of the man they called the engineer, Ayush, I think his name was. And he answered the phone, and they intercepted the call, heard that he was on the phone. They blew his head off. On October 7th, the Hamas was able to gain access to, one of the most sensitive intelligence headquarters for Israel in that theater of operations, where they not only learned who the human intelligence assets that Israel was running inside Hamas, but they learned about how Israel was monitoring Hamas cell phones, how Israel was, taking control of supply chains and getting cell phones inserted into the supply chain so that they could better monitor, track, and indeed kill Hamas operatives. Hamas, I'm certain, shared that intelligence with Hezbollah, with the Axis of Resistance. It may have led to the replacement of the pagers by Hezbollah as a precaution. We don't know what triggered this. Did Israel put high explosive in these pagers? Maybe Edward Snowden believes that this could have been done just by using a hack that overwhelms the lithium battery and causing that to explode. I don't know. It's too early in this. But what we do know is that if you are an enemy of Israel and you use electronic devices, respect the fact that 8200 is one of the best damn units out there that in the cyber electronic warfare signals intelligence business. And you're their enemy. They're not going to just sit there and let you do what you want to do. Your computers, your cell phones, your pagers, anything electronic that you use will be turned into a weapon against you. And now 1,500 plus Hezbollah operatives, their friends, their families, anybody near that pager when it went off, it paid the price. And Hezbollah will, I'm certain they're just not going to sit there and take it. There will be an escalation. But let this be a lesson to anybody who is the enemy of Israel, the enemy of the United States, the enemy of any nation that has good cyber warfare, electronic warfare capabilities. This will kill you. Okay. They just don't monitor and listen to it. They don't just take control of your cameras and watch what you're, look at you. This has become a weapon. They will kill you. And that's my takeaway from this. I'm not going to call this an act of terrorism. This is war. And from the Israeli perspective, Hezbollah is a terrorist organization. It doesn't matter whether I agree with it, you agree with it, anybody else. Israel treats them as terrorists, which means that, you know, the normal rules don't apply, if they ever applied. You know, Hezbollah is a mature organization that's supposed to be up to speed on modern warfare, hybrid warfare, etc. You got outplayed. The Israelis, you know, won this victory. It's a battle. It's not the war. Now the question is, what is Hezbollah going to do about it? And we'll wait and see. I'm sure they will come up with something. And then Israel will have to ask the question, well, what are we going to do about that? And then the cycle of violence continues.
Yeah, this is important, the cycle of violence, and how, because in their mind, do you think with the current situation of the Netanyahu administration, they're trying to replace the Minister of Defense right now? Because it seems that in the eyes of Netanyahu and his administration, he's not that much radical toward Hezbollah. And why, in your opinion, why he's resisting not to attack Hezbollah, the Minister of Defense of Israel, right now?
Well, first of all, let's not personalize this. That's Netanyahu's big mistake, is that he's personalized this. The Minister of Defense takes guidance from the Chief of Staff of the Israeli Army, who takes guidance from his component commanders, who take guidance from the officers and men under them. He doesn't speak as an individual. He speaks in his capacity as the civilian leadership of the military. And he's relaying to Netanyahu the military's reluctance to implement these policies. So by firing him and replacing him with a yes man, understand that, again, the job of the Minister of Defense is not to act in an independent manner. He's supposed to reflect, the advice that he's been given by his military officers. If a new person comes in who says, yes, we want to go in, that doesn't change the fact that the Israeli military is against this. So it doesn't solve any problems for Netanyahu. It just creates more problems for him, because there's a reason why the Israeli military doesn't want to go to war against Hezbollah. They'll lose. Now, people say, well, wait a minute, didn't Unit 8200 just kill or wound, maim 1,500 Hezbollah operatives? Yes, they did. It's a huge blow to Hezbollah, huge blow. But we have to treat this in isolation. This wasn't part and parcel of a grand Israeli strategy. This is an act of revenge on a unit that was attacked by Hezbollah, that lost, maybe lost its commanding officer, maybe lost a lot of senior people that the Israelis, that 8200 didn't want to lose. I think you have to view this in isolation. But Israel does not, the Israeli military does not want a war with Hezbollah. That's one thing that is certain, because they can't win a war with Hezbollah. You get to pull the pager stunt once. They did it. That's it. Don't get to do it again. Hezbollah is not that stupid. You shot that bolt. You got the result you wanted. Now you have to pay the price, because Hezbollah will respond. And then the question is, does this draw Israel into a war it didn't want to get into? Maybe you shouldn't have popped off 1,500 Hezbollah members if you haven't thought through the consequences. Who knows? But I think what happened with the pagers is more an act of revenge than part and parcel of a grand strategy of Israel towards Hezbollah.
Yeah, because it seems that they're talking about that this type of attack is just preparing the situation to have a bigger attack on Hezbollah, just disconnect them from each other.
No.
Doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't change the battlefield outcome. So I said, this was an act of revenge by Unit 8200. That's it. Pure and simple. 8200 may have been sitting on this capability, and they could have pulled this trigger in war. But the thing is, once you go to war, those pagers disappear. Electronics disappear. You don't communicate. Cell phones get put into devices that shield this. They go to wartime communications capabilities, runners, landlines, things of that nature. So, you know, this is a capability that has almost zero utility in time of actual war, because those pagers are gone. No one's carrying around electronics in war. But we're still in this, you know, sort of hybrid warfare moment where there's combat going on in the front, but people still operate as if things are normal in the rear. And Unit A200 gets to pull this off one time. They did it. It's done. But it's not, this isn't a weapon used in war. This is a weapon you'd use as a precursor. Now, had this happened in a vacuum, just out of the blue, they said, pop, 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 I'd say, oh, maybe they're getting ready to do something. But I think this happened because 8200 took a heavy hit, and this is their act of revenge.
Yeah. Before this, we had Houthis using a ballistic missile, it seems, that to attack Israel and a military base, I don't know if somewhere near Tel Aviv. How capable right now, can we have any sort of understanding on how capable Houthis are right now and how many missiles do they have, in your opinion?
We know they had at least one and it hit its target and the Israelis couldn't shoot it down. The Americans couldn't shoot it down. Nobody could shoot it down. Sort of answers the question about how capable that missile is. It doesn't matter if it meets the classical definition of hypersonic. I think it does. The Houthi call it a hypersonic system. We know that its performance characteristics are such that it was not able to be intercepted by the Israelis using their most advanced systems or the United States. How many do they have? I think the Houthi are smarter than the average dog, and means they have more than one. That they have this capability. They demonstrated this capability. They're inviting an Israeli response. Let's see what the Israelis do. And then the Houthi will unleash the remainder of their missiles, which are probably, you know, can be counted in the dozens at a minimum. And Israel will pay a heavy price because they can't shoot them down. There is no solution to these missiles. Iran, which has these missiles in the many hundreds, if not thousands, Hezbollah has similar capabilities in the many hundreds, if not thousands. The Houthi just did a proof of concept demonstration to the Israelis that hypersonics will penetrate anything you got and hit the targets they want to hit, and there's nothing you can do to stop it. And that sends a chilling effect. The Houthi did that because it's difficult for Iran and Hezbollah to do now, given the level of tensions. That's why it's just one missile. This is the Houthi sending a signal to Israel that the Axis resistance has your number. We can destroy you anytime we want to. You can't shoot down our missiles. We'll hit every target we aim at. And I think the message was received. I think it is another reason why the 8200 pager attack took place. Because while Netanyahu is screaming about going into Lebanon, the military saying we can't stop Hezbollah from hitting us with these hypersonic missiles. And the Houthi now have said they're going to join in on that fight. And what happens if Iran joins in on that fight? We all die. And so while they're talking about this, you know, while Netanyahu is, reviewing the fate of Gallant, 8200 went, well, screw it. Boom, take out the Hezbollah guys just because we're mad. I'm sure they coordinate with their leadership, but I think it's just an independent action that has nothing to do with the overall Israeli Hezbollah direction that's heading place. You know, 8200 got hit hard by Hezbollah and they got their revenge.
It seems that the way that they're trying to dissipate the focus on the part of Israelis, because Hezbollah and after that Houthis, and right now again Israelis are attacking Hezbollah. And did you find this attack of Houthis as a part of Iranian response to Israel, because they don't want to attack Israel directly, or maybe they're planning?
Oh, 100%. I mean, first of all, with all due respect to Ansarallah, and I don't mean to diminish them at all. They carried out testing for this missile. If this was an indigenous, Yemeni designed and produced missile, there's just significant testing that has to take place to turn design concepts into reality. Static burns of the rocket design. It never goes right the first time. It doesn't go right the second time. Usually it doesn't go right till about the 10th or 15th time. When they go, oh, we got the formula, the design, oh, everything right. It performed well. Now we have a booster. Now you got to take that booster. You got to have a second stage. That second stage also has to be tested, different performance characteristics and everything that you're looking at. Then you got to assemble it, and then you got to do the flight testing, see if the guidance works and things of that nature. And all, none of this happens the first time. You don't go, let's test the booster. Boom, perfect test. Wow. Let's test the second stage. Boom, perfect test. Wow. Let's do a flight test. Whew, functions perfectly. Let's go into full operational, you know, full scale production and turn this thing into an operational missile. It doesn't work that way. You need to do multiple tests. So the Houthi did this very fast test, which tells me that they've received components from Iran that they're assembling. They may incorporate some indigenous, produced parts and components to that missile. But by and large, this is an Iranian design that's been sent to Hezbollah that Hezbollah is able to assemble. Hezbollah maybe was given the production designs so that they could build a production capacity that could replicate that which is done. So maybe they produced some and they did a quality assurance test to make sure that functions according to design. But if it does and you've done everything right, that's whether you produce it in Yemen or produce it in Iran, doesn't matter. It's an Iranian design. The bottom line is this is an Iranian missile. And it functioned and Iran sent a signal to Israel. The Israelis aren't stupid. I mean, I worked with them in the 1980s, right after the Gulf War. They assembled all the different ballistic missile parts from the various missiles that Iran had fired into Israel into something like a Scud graveyard, little museum for missile geeks. And, the Israelis reverse engineered these things. And then as a weapons inspector, traveled to Israel, I got to go to the Scud graveyard and deal with these missile geeks and work with them. And, we brought out new information about Iraqi efforts regarding the reverse engineering of this. And we went back and looked at the various parts and, suddenly things that the Israelis didn't have answers to, they suddenly had answers to. And then together we looked at it and we started to say, oh, well, the Iraqis could do this. The Iraqis could do that. And then we could take it to the Iraqis after they said, well, we couldn't do that. We'd say, well, you could, here's the evidence. And they went, oh yeah, I guess we did do that. And we got the truth. The point I'm trying to bring out is the Israelis are pretty damn good. They can take bits and pieces of missiles and put them together and do the reverse engineering necessary to understand the totality of it. I'm sure that they have picked up debris from this attack and they are reading. I don't want to get too far into it because it's fascinating for me. It probably bore your audience to death, but to take a piece of debris and then make it tell a story is just fascinating science because, and you have to know everything about how missiles are produced to do that. You have to know about, manufacturing techniques because you're looking at welds. You have to know about if it's liquid, the kind of metal that's used, the rolling processes that are used to create the stage. You can look at that when you look at the thickness of it. And so you're able to start to say, oh, this is how it happened. This is how it was done. And then you start to get a bigger picture and then you can investigate those parts. And then the whole thing comes together just from a little piece. And the Israelis are doing that now. And I'm certain the Israelis, because they're not stupid, are going to look at, fuel composition. I'm sure there's aspects of the solid fuel that survive. They're going to look at fuel composition. They're going to be able to reverse engineer that to find out, what the various chemical ingredients are, where you source these chemical ingredients. Does Yemen have the ability to source these chemical ingredients? Is there any evidence of Yemen sourcing these chemical ingredients or Iran? Does Iran produce it indigenously or does Iran have to acquire capabilities from abroad? And then you spread that thing out. And the Israelis are going to be able, from looking at a piece of debris, put together a picture that will be fairly accurate. Fairly accurate. It won't be 100% because there's just different things. You're doing a lot of speculation here. And if you start speculating down a one track, that's happened before. we were going in one way and suddenly went, well, that was a nice story that we told ourselves, but we were wrong about the very first thing we were looking at. Because we got it wrong, all the speculation led us down a false pit trail. So you can get it wrong, but the Israelis are pretty good. And I'm sure they know, and this is important. The reason why I'm bringing this up is that they will produce a report that goes to their military leadership about capabilities. And they will do an assessment based on that, on what they think the production capacity of Yemen is, or Iran. Based upon the complexity of the missile, you can make a guess of what it would take to assemble such a missile. What the infrastructure support requirements of are that, then what the production rate would be. And from that, you can determine what the possible size of the arsenal of Yemen is, the availability, or Iran, or Hezbollah. And then you can say, we can't shoot this thing down, and they've got X number of them, and we're in a lot of trouble. So all that from a little piece of debris.
Yeah. But in the eyes of Israelis right now, when you look at the situation, it's not just Hamas and Hezbollah. You see Iraqis, you see Houthis, you see even in Syria. Do they understand what's going on with their position right now? Because the way that they're trying to escalate, if you were to advise them, what would you say to them? Because right now with the situation and the way that they're trying to escalate the situation, it doesn't seem that any good outcome would come out of this for Israel and the way that they're trying to attack Hezbollah. And because of the conflict with Hamas, they're just involved in Gaza, and how they can just focus on all of these fronts on their part. Can you understand that?
Well, I mean, first of all, when evaluating what's happening in Israel today, stop talking about Israel. Stop. You're talking about the wrong thing. Remember what I said? If you got that little piece of missile and you get it wrong on your initial take, and you say, aha, that's an assumption we made now based upon this. And then we go down and we do this whole analytical chain. But because we got it wrong here, all of this doesn't matter because it's fantasy. If you start by talking about the security of Israel, you're talking about the wrong thing. Because if you talk about the security of Israel, then everything we're talking about makes no sense. Because Israel is destroying itself, literally destroying itself. It's destroying itself economically. It's destroying itself socially. It's destroying itself domestically in terms of politics and globally in terms of geopolitics. There's nothing going right for Israel right now, nothing. And everything is going wrong is leading Israel down a path of its imminent collapse, literal collapse. Israel is committing suicide as we speak. And many Israelis know this, they recognize this. So stop talking about Israeli security. Start talking about Netanyahu's political legacy. This is about the preservation of a narcissist, of a man who has put himself above Israel, above Israeli security. It's only about Netanyahu and what can preserve his political viability and the political viability of the very limited coalition that he's built around himself to govern. A coalition, in order to survive, needs to project itself as a wartime coalition, because that's the only way it can justify its continued hold on power. If Israel were to head down the path of peace, if a ceasefire was arranged, then Israelis would be called upon to solve a whole host of issues, which are the source to the problems created by Netanyahu and this coalition. So everything that's happening, whether it be a conflict with Hezbollah, continued violence in Hamas, it's all about Netanyahu preserving his hold on power. And as such, all these problems we talked about for Israel will just continue to get worse and worse and worse and worse. And the Israelis are increasingly coming to that awareness. The question now is, what do they do about it? But here's the problem. There's a whole bunch of people that were in the streets, hundreds of thousands, that were demanding Netanyahu's resignation over the hostages. And there's many people outside of Israel that said, see, there's sanity in Israel. Hundreds of thousands of people rallying against Benjamin Netanyahu. Yeah, that's exactly right. Rallying against Benjamin Netanyahu. You know what they weren't rallying against? Genocide. They weren't rallying against violence against the Palestinians. The vast majority of Israelis today support the continuation of violence. They support the concept of a greater Israel. They support Zionism. So even when you get rid of Netanyahu, there's no solution to this problem. Israel is going to die. It has no choice, because in order to survive, Israel has to do things that it can't survive. In order to survive, Israel is going to have to solve its geopolitical problem. And that can only happen with the creation of a Palestinian state. Right now, the the term being bandied around is a two-state solution. Okay, let's talk about that. What does that mean, a two-state solution? Well, first of all, you have to overcome, well, who's going to govern the Palestinian state? Israel has put forward a precondition that says Hamas will not be allowed to govern. Well, Hamas is getting around that by working with the Chinese and the Russians and the other Palestinian factions to create this this joint governing authority, of which Hamas will be a part of, but it won't be called Hamas anymore. And they're going to try and slide that in there. Even if Israel says, okay, we'll work with those guys. What do you do about the West Bank? You see, Israel's been engaged in illegal actions in the West Bank. The West Bank settlements will have to be dismantled. There's no other option. You can't have a two-state solution and have West Bank settlements. Incompatible. But if Israel, in order to survive, Israel has to, take it down itself down a path of viability for a two-state solution, which means Israel will have to dismantle the West Bank settlements. There you'll have a civil war, a literal civil war. The West Bank settlers have been armed. They are an independent militia. The police force in the West Bank has been politicized to the extent that their sole job is to empower the settlers to continue to murder, rob, steal, rape, whatever they do against the Palestinians. This all has to go, and it's not going to go peacefully. There will be violence. And I don't see Israel embarking on a policy of self-destruction. So, right off the bat, we're saying that a two-state solution isn't going to happen, and it isn't going to happen. So now what happens? Because Israel can't create a two-state solution, the only answer now is going to be a one-state solution, and that isn't going to be greater Israel. That's the Israeli solution for a one state. Yeah, we already have it. Call it greater Israel. Get rid of the Palestinians. Isn't going to happen. What's going to happen is Israel, in launching these rearguard actions, is going to continue to see its standing in the world community deteriorate. They're going to continue to see domestic divisions as Israelis begin to recognize that the only choice they have is a two-state solution, but now they have to dismantle, so there's going to be problems there. The economy will never recover from where it is right now. In order for the economy to recover, you're going to need Israel to normalize relationship with states who say we can't normalize until there's a two-state solution. And we already said that isn't going to happen. So the economy will continue to deteriorate, and the security situation will never stabilize. Even with a ceasefire, as long as Israel's at odds with its neighbors, as long as you have issues in Hamas, there's going to be violence or the threat of violence. And eventually the combination of the economic collapse of Israel with a social environment that isn't conducive to the image that Israel tries to sell to the world of this peaceful nation where people come in prosperity and live in harmony with everything, that isn't going to happen. And people are going to flee, and that's the death of Israel. When you get more people fleeing than are coming in, there is Aliyah. Yes, there's a romanticism attached to Israel amongst the Jewish diaspora. And, tens of thousands of Israelis return every year, maybe hundreds of thousands. I don't know. But what we have right now is hundreds of thousands of Israelis leaving. And when that number turns into the millions and is sustained over a period of time, you'll see the Israeli population drop from its current level of 9 million. If the population drops down to 6 million to 5 million and the non-Jewish population is, 9, 10, 11, 12 million, 15 million, demographics alone dictates the outcome, which is a single state solution called Palestine. And I think that's the direction we're heading right now.
Do you think that the intelligence they're receiving from the United States is telling them the reality of what's going on for Israel, or they're just the same thing happening as in Ukraine? They're just reporting not totally in line with the reality of what's going on the battlefield between Ukraine and Russia, but right now between Israel and Palestinians and Hezbollah. I'm talking about the intelligence, how intelligence is honest with Israeli on the part of the United States.
Well, the problem is, in order to be honest with Israel, the United States has to be honest with itself. Given the overwhelming influence of the pro-Israeli lobby in the United States, it's impossible to have this kind of honesty. I mean, the first thing we'd have to ask ourselves is the pro-Israeli lobby seeking to influence the outcome of the 2024 presidential election? There's the fundamental question. It's one that one would hope that the Department of Justice, its National Security Division, would ask with the same fervor as appears to be asking whether Russia is interfering with the 2024 presidential election. One would hope that the FBI's National Security Division would investigate these pro-Israeli factions with the same fervor that they investigate, those who are alleged to be operating on behalf of Russia. You know, one is a fantasy, that's the Russian story, and the other one is reality, the Israeli story that we don't want to confront. So we're not even honest with ourselves. So when you start off, just the opening proposition is America is incapable of being honest with itself about Israel, then the intelligence doesn't matter, because for intelligence to work, just a quick briefing on what intelligence is. People keep going, well, intelligence is what happens when an American hands the Israelis a piece of paper and says, read our intelligence. And the Israelis go, oh my God, you're so smart. You're so wise. Oh, we should have listened to you to begin with. That doesn't work that way. The first thing in intelligence, in order for it to become intelligence, is that you need direction. All right. Forget all the spy versus spy stuff right now. The first component of intelligence is direction. That means a consumer, the president, the National Security Council, Congress, Department of Defense, somebody says, I want to know this, puts out a question. And then the intelligence people, that would be me putting on my intelligence hat, go, oh, let me talk to you more about your question. What exactly do you want to know? And I dig down into it. And I find out why he's asking the question, what he wants to know, or she. And I say, okay, I got this one. And I come back to my shop and I break it down. I say, here's the big question. Now, to answer this, we have to ask additional questions. We call these essential elements of information that in their totality allow me to, if I answer all these, I'm able to come up with an answer to the big question. And I break down each EEI. And then those are broken down into individual intelligence collection requirements. And those are actions that need to be taken, questions. We got the EEIs, I break them down into specific things. And then in order to answer each one of these things, I have to link it to an intelligence collection capability. Human intelligence, signals intelligence, imagery intelligence, we call MASINT, overall signals intelligence, open source intelligence. There's a whole bunch of different sources, and we cast them out to the collectors, and then the collectors go out and collect. Or do they? Well, because if you're a human intelligence collector and now you're going out to collect, you still have to come up with a human intelligence collection plan. I need to meet this person. I need to get access to this person who's going to answer the question that we've asked. We've said, who can answer it? This person can answer it. How do I get to them? This is what I need to do to get to them. And then supervisors look at it and go, whoa, what? You think you're going to do that? That isn't going to happen. No. Boom, that's too politically sensitive. The ambassador may say, because the ambassador runs all CIA operations inside his country or her country that they're in, and they may say, no, that's stupid. You're not going to get to do that. And so there's already manipulation taking place. Sir, I want to intercept the phone calls of Emmanuel Macron because I want to know what he's saying to this person. Yes or no? It could get blocked. So even as you break this down, there's all. And then once you collect this information, it goes through the basic assessment. You collect it and say, what does this mean? And that's done at the local level, the junior guy. You do that. And it gets up to a mid-level analyst who now brings it together. That's their job, to bring it all together and answer the question. Write something to answer the question. The problem with the mid-level guy is two things. One, they don't do the actual briefing of the boss. They just put it together. Two, they want to be the person that briefs the boss. They want to get promoted. And so they'll write it. And it's an honest reflection of the actual intelligence that's been collected, even though maybe you weren't allowed to collect all the intelligence you needed. And then you present it to your boss and say, this answers the question. And the boss goes, no, it doesn't. Because your answer is no. The boss wants the answer to be yes. But sir, it doesn't. This is no. No, you're not understanding me, Scott. If you want to be the person to get promoted, this has to say yes. And then I have to go back and rewrite it. So it says yes. And then my boss takes it and takes it to the consumer and says yes. And then we take it and give it to somebody who reads it and says, oh my God, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. No, it's a lie. A lie. 100% lie. And that's the problem with U.S. intelligence and Israel. We can't be honest with ourselves. The mid-level analyst responsible for, you know, assessing the data to produce the assessment that gets sent up to the top isn't allowed to give the answer they want because politically it's unacceptable. If you could give the answer you want, we'd shut AIPAC down a long time ago for being, they brag about spending $100 million to buy elections. They spent $24 million to defeat somebody in a primary and nothing's happening. Nothing's happening. I can guarantee you that every junior analyst is going, that's the biggest problem we face right now. Not allowed to talk about that. You gotta only talk about this. And you're only allowed to give the answer that the boss already wants. They ask the question knowing the answer they want. And that's the problem, is the direction. If the direction is honest, I really want to know the answer to this because it will influence the decisions I make. But what's really happening is I've already made my decision. Now I need to cover my butt. I need the intelligence to back me up on this. So it's not intelligence. It's fiction. It's fiction writing. Very expensive fiction writing.
Yeah. How do you find the next 2 to 3 weeks for the position of Netanyahu? Do you think that he's going to do something big? Because his position is not that good right now. And what does he need to do, in your opinion, in his eyes? And what is he trying to do to improve his position in Israel?
Survive. That's all he's about right now, is survival. It's how do I, Benjamin Netanyahu, last until November 6th? Because on November 6th, a fundamental question is going to be answered. Who's going to be the next president of the United States? And at that point in time, Israel is liberated. See, right now, Israel can't go against the policies of Joe Biden because Joe Biden's the president of the United States. And if they go against the policies, it makes Biden look bad, and then Biden can do things to punish Israel that normally wouldn't be politically viable. But now in the time where they're trying to desperately keep Donald Trump out of office, there's no telling what Biden will do to stay the course with the policy it deems to be most conducive to putting Kamala Harris in the White House. The Israelis can't work on the assumption that Donald Trump's going to be the president, because if he's not, then they hung themselves out to dry. So Netanyahu's job right now is to survive between now and November 5th. And then on November 6th, Netanyahu will take a look at the reality that's manifested itself because of the will of the American people, and he'll adjust accordingly. And that's what I think is going to happen for the next, 50 odd days before the election.
I do believe that nobody gonna support Netanyahu the way that the Biden administration did, because in any sort of, if Kamala Harris wins or Donald Trump, both of them have their sort of policy toward Israel. Donald Trump is willing to support Israel as much as possible, but at the end of the day, he's not willing to risk a war, a big war in the Middle East, because he knows how important that would be for the economy of the United States, for the economy of all of these countries in the European Union. And on the other hand, Kamala Harris is not that much in line with the Biden's policy. The way that she was talking about their policy in Gaza, I do believe that she's not totally in line with what Biden did so far. Do you think that in the eyes of Israelis is the same, or they're finding differently?
Well, first of all, let's talk about Kamala Harris. I don't think she knows anything about Israel. I don't think she knows anything about the complexity of this problem. What she knows is that she has a problem in certain swing states, Michigan, Wisconsin, that she has to win to win the White House. And she's lost the Muslim American population there. In fact, as much of the Muslim American population, which in a very tight race nationally, is against her. And this could cost her the election. So she's advised by people who say you need to assuage them, to say things that's, you know, that make them believe that you're on their side, but she doesn't truly believe it. So one of the problems right now is, you know, if you're talking about Kamala Harris, you don't know what she's going to do on November 6th. You literally don't know, because once the election is done, if she won, she doesn't need the Muslim American community anymore. She'll dump them like a bad habit. She'll go the easy route, because what she'll need then is the support of the establishment on not just issues pertaining to Israel, but pertaining to Russia, to China, et cetera. It's all tied in. And she's not going to go against the establishment. Donald Trump, on the other hand, you know, is putting a lot of effort into winning over the pro-Israeli crowd. But we don't know what he's going to do on the 6th. The pro-Israeli crowd is part of the same establishment that's backing bad policy in Ukraine and in China. And Donald Trump is a businessman. Donald Trump is going to want to do things that improve the economy of the United States. So you don't know what Donald Trump's going to do on November 6th. Now you come to Biden. Biden is a lame duck president. He has to make sure that Donald Trump doesn't become the next president of the United States. In order to do that, his policies have to conform with what Kamala Harris is saying on the, you know, on the campaign trail. But on November 6th, he has between then and January, you know, what, 20th, to put his final thing. And you say, well, no lame duck president does that. I just want to remind people that George Herbert Walker Bush, when he turned the presidency over to Bill Clinton, his last act was to attack Iraq, because he wanted to make sure that Bill Clinton, a man who said that he's willing to work with the Iraqis to resolve these problems, entered the White House at war with Iraq. So, you know, the presidents are capable of doing very dangerous things policy-wise to tie the hands of their successor. And so Biden, you know, who knows? Again, different options for different outcomes. But, you know, he may be opposed to things that Kamala Harris says. And if she doesn't surround herself with people that match the Biden policy objectives, Biden could try and tie her hands with doing things in Israel one way or the other. The same thing with Donald Trump. I guess what I'm trying to say is anybody who thinks that they know what's going to happen between now and November is smoking dope. And if you think you know what the outcome is going to be come January on Inauguration Day, again, you're smoking dope. This is a very complicated question that's fraught with problems domestic and international.
The Hill newspaper reported that Donald Trump, together with RFK Jr., they're asking to have some sort of negotiations with Russians because of the tensions that are increasing that may lead to a nuclear war. And how is that serious in the conflict in Ukraine, in your opinion?
Well, look, I'm going to be as serious as I am. I've said this on other podcasts. I'll say it here. I just hope that everybody in your audience knows. You yourself, are you married? I don't mean to ask personal questions, but I know you have kids. Yeah. You love your family?
No.
What did you do this weekend? Did you take them out? Did you enjoy life? You know, you almost died on Saturday. Do you know that? Are you aware of that? Or are you pretending it didn't happen? Because had Joe Biden signed off on the proposal that Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, brought in to greenlight the use of Storm Shadow cruise missiles and American ATACMS missiles against targets inside Russia, we'd all be dead. Because it would have triggered a nuclear war. The Russians said, from Vladimir Putin to the ambassador at the United Nations to the Russian ambassador here in the United States, that this would be an act of war. In fact, the Russian ambassador at the United Nations in session with the Security Council said it will be a declaration of war. And I believe there was a back channel communication, because all of that wasn't resonating. There was a final back channel communication, the content of which I don't know, but I think I know. And I think they said, these are the targets we're going to hit. And the decision's been made. If you do this, this is automatic. You can't stop it. That's why Biden was so mad. Did you see him at his when you get ready to meet with Starmer? Because he was ready. They were ready. They had it all together. Starmer brought the big red box with all the documents. They were going to sign off on this thing because Russia's bluffing. Russia's bluffing. Russia's bluffing. Russia wasn't bluffing. And someone said, what do you think about Putin's thing? I don't give much mind to Putin. Look at that angry old man. You know why he was angry? Because he was humiliated by the Russians. But this isn't about humiliation. What it's about is that a man named Volodymyr Zelensky has put political pressure on the United States, Great Britain, and NATO to allow him to do something that everybody knows will has the potential of triggering a nuclear war. And they almost did it. They almost signed off on it. We almost all died this weekend. Do you understand that? I don't think people understand it. 72 minutes is all it takes from the initiation of the first action to the end of the world. 72 frickin' minutes. Whatever the hell you were doing this weekend, you wouldn't have gotten to do it. I went to a movie. You wouldn't have gotten to see the end of the movie. Took my kids for a walk. They ain't coming home. Took my dogs for a walk. You ain't coming home either. There would be no home. And if there is, the consequences of surviving the initial nuclear exchange are worse than dying in the initial nuclear exchange. Nikita Khrushchev said it. The survivors will envy the dead. I don't think everybody gets it. I don't think your audience gets it. I think they're just saying that, guys, we all almost died this weekend. It's the closest we came to nuclear war since the Cuban Missile Crisis. One stroke of the pen would have all been taken. They were getting ready to sign the freaking documents. Biden was lined up with Starmer. They had the paperwork ready. And it's only because the Russians said, if you do this, this is what's going to happen. We're not bluffing. And thank God, somebody close to Biden went, they ain't bluffing. They're not. And Biden made the right decision. But they're still going to talk about it. Now you're going to go up into General Assembly and talk about it. Zelensky's going to come here and talk about it. How much longer are we going to allow this insane man in Kiev to hold the fate of the world in his hands? When are we going to take charge and say, oh, we don't want to die. I want to go to the movies. I want to walk the dogs. I want to play with my kids. I want to live. Because that's what this is about. This isn't stupid academic parlor games with, you know, drunk people in the back room smoking cigars going, well, you know, the Russians are bluffing. Well, you know, historically speaking, blah, blah, blah. No, they're not bluffing. This is about America and Great Britain enabling Ukraine to attack Russian cities using weapons provided by the United States and Great Britain, using targets developed by the United States and Great Britain, inserted into the weapon systems by American and British hands. People need to understand, ATACMS can't be launched. It's a GPS-guided system, GPS inertial guidance system. But if it's GPS, commercial GPS, like we all use, well, maybe, Scott, I got a Garmin. Great. You got a single signal between you and the Garmin, and I can jam it anytime I want, and then you're stupid. You don't have anything. You have to use military-grade GPS. That's two signals. In order to make those signals work, they're encrypted. You have to be able to decrypt them. So there's a little device that gets plugged in there, and you have to load in the encryption. Only Americans and NATO get to do that. Part of a schedule published by the National Security Agency. So before each ATACMS can be used to launch, to make sure it doesn't get, that GPS doesn't get jammed, an American or NATO hand has to load up the encryption. That means that we're making this possible. That missile can't hit Russian territory without an American hand. And the Russians are going, that means you're attacking us. Literally, it means you're attacking us. You're a party to the conflict. With the Storm Shadow, it's even more. It uses GPS, again, that whole encryption thing we just talked about. It uses an inertial navigation system, but it also uses something called terrain, basically terrain following, TERRACOM. And this is maps made by the United States, only the United States, of the terrain maps with all the features. We block that in, and then we have to program in more refined things. This is all done targeting. We have a targeting cell. There's a name for it. I forget it. But we have them in the Pacific. We have them in the Atlantic. We have them in the United States. The targeting cell is responsible for different parts of the world. And what it does is if you want to hit a target, it will then do a couple things. It's going to pick the route that you need to fly to avoid terrain features. You don't want to run into buildings, pylons, mountains, etc. You're going to pick the route, but you're also going to overlay it, the intelligence, that where enemy air defense systems are. You're going to go around that. Only we have this. Only we're capable of putting it all together into a target package that we designed. The Ukrainians can say this is the target we want to hit, but to hit that target, we have to build the target package. And then it gets sent encrypted, by the way. I know that's inconvenient, but it's sent encrypted on the ground to the people near the missile who aren't Ukrainians. They're not, because Ukrainians aren't allowed to be anywhere near this encryption. And then it gets loaded into this missile by these non-Ukrainian hands, probably hands that say made in Great Britain or made in America, because it's American targeting data, baby. We developed the target. And then it's loaded on and it's fired. To do a target like this, you need 24 to 48 hours minimum to plan. This isn't a spontaneous target. That means that the United States for 24 to 48 hours is planning a literal attack using a NATO weapon against Russian target. We're the parties to the conflict. And Vladimir Putin said, we know this. You say, well, how does he know it? Scott Ritter, you gave away national secrets. No, everything I just said is publicly. It's in the public domain. But the Russians have, just so you know, captured intact the ATACMS warhead to include the guidance. They found the port. They know what that port's for. It's where the targeting, the GPS encryption's put in, because they pulled out the chips and they were able to read it and they reverse engineer it and they got it all. They know everything. They captured intact the storm shadow. They know everything. They were able to reverse engineer it. They know this. So when Putin says, we know how this works, he's not guessing. He's not going off of open source intelligence. The Russians know this and confirmed it. He knows without a shadow of doubt that if that is used to hit a Russian target, an American or British hand touched it, it was planned in the United States, and he's not going to let that happen. We wouldn't let that happen. Imagine if Russia gave Mexico a bunch of missiles that Russia targeted, used Russian satellites, and gave it to the Mexicans, to the cartel or somebody, and said, hit Denver. And boom, Denver blows up. And Russia says, no, no, it was the Mexicans that did it. No, it wasn't. You did it. You gave them the weapon. You gave them the intelligence. You loaded it in. And you helped them fire it. We blame Russia. Well, that's what Russia just did. They blamed us. Rightfully so. You know, and Antonov made one of the final points, because the first thing is Putin said it. He said it on Thursday. That still wasn't good enough. Starmer showed up with the damn briefcase. They were going to sign these documents because they don't trust Putin. So the UN ambassador, the Russian ambassador, UN in session, said this will be a declaration of war. And they still went, ah, he's bluffing. Ah, he's bluffing, man. That's just bluff. Ah. Anatoly Antonov, I saw him Friday night. I went to the Russian embassy on Friday night to attend a cultural event, a piano concert, Rimsky-Korsakov and other Russian composers. Part of the effort, ongoing effort of the Russian embassy to sort of, you know, show people the culture of Russia so that they say, well, maybe the Russians aren't just brutal savages. But he was sort of distracted and I would say not on his diplomatic game. Why? Because he had to give an interview prior to this on instructions from his government to tell the United States that if they sign off on this, remember, he's the Russian ambassador. He's responsible for the Russians in the United States, that Russia will attack the United States. Russia will attack the United States. That's the message he sent. Russia will attack the United States. And now you're the Russian ambassador at a cultural event going, I hope those bastards heard what I said. Because if they didn't, this all ends. I mean, and that didn't work. They still think he's bluffing. So I think one more phone call was made. And that's where the back channel was used. Thank God for the back channel. You know, the back channel saved our ass during a Cuban Missile Crisis. I think it saved our ass now, because still we don't believe him. Anatoly Antonov said things before. We just say, well, he's the ambassador taking instructions. He's bluffing. The Russian ambassador to the United Nations has said things before. Just bluffing. Putin, just bluffing. Somebody made a phone call on Friday that said, we're not bluffing. And the phone call contained enough substance to convince the receiver that they weren't bluffing. Was this at the Pentagon level? Was this done to the CIA? I don't know. What I do know is there's somebody right now in the American media that knows this. But why aren't they saying this? This is information we, the people, should need. We need to know now. We need to know why Biden backed down. We need to know that Biden was shown evidence that said Russia will go to war against the United States if you do this. Why do we need to know that? So we understand the consequences the next time loudmouth and Zelensky starts begging for permission to use long-range missiles. We, the people that don't want to die, need to shout down, don't listen to him, get rid of him, disregard him. We're not going to die for Ukraine. We are not willing to die for Ukraine. I'm not putting my family's lives on the line for Ukraine. That isn't going to happen. This story will come out, mark my words, sometime in December, January, before whoever got elected gets sworn in. If we're still alive, then somebody will release, you know, what happened, the inside story of how Biden backed down, you know, blah, 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 blah. But by then it won't matter. Now it matters. Right now it matters. We need to know this. Why did the president change his mind? We need to know that the Russians aren't bluffing. We need to know this so that all the pundits on American TV can be put on notice. Stop selling my death. I don't want to die. Not for Ukraine. Not for Zelensky. Not for this insanity that's going on in Europe today. And I hope everybody who's watching the show reaches the same conclusion. I don't want to die. You shouldn't want to die. Your family shouldn't have to die because of the stupidity of the West's approach to Ukraine. No matter where you stand on how this conflict started, I believe that Russia's on the right side of history, but you can say that Russia's not on the right side of history. What you have to understand is that Russia isn't losing this war. They're not going to. I mean, German Olaf Scholz got that signal from the head of Kazakhstan, who said Russia is militarily invincible right now. You're not going to beat them. But let's just break this down even further. Russia's a nuclear power. Its nuclear doctrine is built upon the premise that if the existential survival of Russia is put at risk, Russia will use its nuclear power to preserve and protect Russian survival. So your policy says, well, we're going to defeat Russia strategically. What part of Russia will use nuclear weapons to ensure that doesn't happen? Are you not understanding? So anybody who's sitting here saying that we're going to use Ukraine as a proxy conflict to bring about the strategic defeat of Russia is stupid, frankly speaking. And if their response is, well, Russia's bluffing. No, they're not. Biden just realized that. They're not bluffing. This is as real as it gets. This threat is real. It's existential in nature. Russia doesn't pose a threat to NATO. Russia's not going to invade NATO. Again, just think about this. How many troops has Russia had to put into the effort to recapture the Donbass, and how slow is that going? How difficult is it for Russia to assemble the forces necessary to recapture Kursk? And how slow is that going? These are hundreds of thousands of troops. Russia just enlarged its military. Putin signed off on it to about 1.5 million, an additional 600,000 troops. Why? Well, because Russia says there are threats, growing threats around our border that we need to have the troops to deal with defensively. Russia is not an offensive inclined power. They don't have the 12 million men needed to do large-scale offensive operations against Europe. So all this nonsense about Russia will follow up its victory in Ukraine by going into Romania, going into... No, it's not. No, it's not. They don't have the military capacity to do this. Now, if Russia is attacked, Russia has the capacity to defend, and their defense is active in nature, which means they will take the fight to you. But that's a fight that you started, not Russia. Russia is not organized to initiate offensive military operations against NATO, and politically they're not inclined to do so. So we need to stop this nonsense about, you know, we have to hold on to Ukraine to defend Europe. If we don't fight them there, we're going to have to fight them here. That's a lie, a straight up lie. A straight up lie. So again, it's sad what's happening to Ukraine. I agree. I believe it's Ukraine's fault and the West's fault for promoting this fight, to begin this fight. Didn't have to have a coup in 2014, didn't have to disregard Minsk, didn't have to ignore the Russian efforts in December 2021 for a new peace framework. You didn't have to do any of the things that we did. We didn't have to get in the way of the peace proposal that was ready to be implemented on April 1st, 2022. There are so many things we didn't have to do, but we did it, and we've lost. It's a failure. We're not going to win this war. It's done. There are 100,000 or more Ukrainians are going to die the longer this goes. You might kill a couple, maybe 100,000 more Russians. yay, but you didn't win. Russia's not defeated. Ukraine will lose. That's the ultimate outcome. It's going to happen. Be adults about it. Accept a defeat and figure out how do we mitigate the consequences of this defeat to pursue a policy that doesn't result in nuclear war. And you can only do that by beginning to have negotiations with the Russians. So now we come back to the Iran. There's a wonderful op-ed written by RFK Jr. and Donald Trump Jr. Now people can say whatever they want about that. That you're missing the point. If your response is, well, that's RFK, you know, he's a vaccine guy, or he's this, or he's that, he's pro-Israel. You're missing the point. That just shows how stupid you are. I apologize for calling people stupid, but at this point, I almost died this past weekend because of your stupidity, so I don't care. You're stupid, really. And if that's Donald Trump Jr., he's the son, he's crazy, he's this, you're missing the point. What's the one thing that RFK Jr. and Donald Trump Jr. can do that you can't do? Talk to Donald Trump. You see, because ultimately it's only Donald Trump's opinion that matters when it comes to Trump world. Wouldn't it be nice if what they wrote reflects the thinking that might be going on inside Camp Trump, you know, when he's not getting assassinated or attempted assassination? What if Trump is actually thinking about how to bring an end to this war, how to prevent a nuclear war? I just want to remind you, we almost died past week because the current president's not thinking like that. And his handpicked candidate, Kamala Harris, isn't thinking like that. Now, what if Donald Trump is thinking like that? You're still going to say, well, I don't want to vote for Trump. Okay, it's not election day. But wouldn't it be nice to have one side say, I'm looking to prevent a nuclear war, and have people say, this is a very important issue because we don't want to die. And suddenly Kamala Harris goes, whoa, how'd this become an issue? How'd this become an issue? People are talking about something that we weren't even thinking. It wasn't on our radar. We're gonna have the most lethal military in the force, and we're going to continue to stand up to Putin. Her support goes down. She realizes the American people are serious about not having a nuclear war with Russia. And so she turns around and says, we got to change our policy. We got to mirror this, because she's done that before. You've seen she takes Trump's policies because they're popular and she makes them her own. So what if Kamala Harris made stopping a nuclear war her own policy? But now she has to do things. She has to turn to Biden and say, hey, you got to support me on this. Maybe send Blinken to Moscow. Maybe talk about New START treaty and how we can keep that alive. Maybe tone down the stupidity about long-range strike capabilities for Ukraine. Maybe tell Ukrainians that they lost the war and grow up and get the best possible degree. Do something, because this has become an issue that's going to play out on November 5th. And now we have two sides. And what if they get in a bidding war? Who's going to be the best to stop a nuclear war with Russia? And now they start going back and forth. And next thing you know, peace is broken out all over. It ain't a pretty path to it, but it's a hell of a lot better. I just want to, again, remind you, we almost died on Saturday. It's not a joke, people. It almost happened. If Biden had signed off on that piece of paper with Keir Starmer on Friday in the White House, as he was planning to do, the paper that Carmer brought over in his little red box. You saw the photograph of him coming off the airplane, carrying his little red official diplomatic communications, his majesty's communications. That box contained the death warrant for you. For you. So stop being stupid about this. There's only one issue that matters come election day. Scott, Israel matters. Not if you're dead. Scott, abortion matters. Not if you're dead. Scott, my Second Amendment right? Not if you're dead. None of it matters if you're dead, and if there's a war between the United States and Russia, you're going to die. Stopping this war is the number one priority and has to be the number one priority of anybody who loves their country, loves their family, loves their kids, loves their dogs, loves going to the movie, loves enjoying life. Because if you had a good weekend, understand that you almost didn't. You were that close, one stroke of the pen for making that the worst weekend in your life. For many of you, it would have been a very short life because you would have died in a nuclear holocaust. For the rest of you, you'd have been praying that you died in a nuclear holocaust as you watch disease befall your family, the people that you love starve to death, die of disease, as you watch your communities fall apart into chaos and anarchy. You kill your neighbor to get the food in their refrigerator. You have to kill your dog and eat your dog because you're out of food or because you don't want to see your dog suffer. You have to leave your home because you can't live anymore and start trudging through this nuclear wasteland. That's your future, ladies and gentlemen. That's your future. It's not a game. It's as real as it gets. So why don't you do something to stop it by maybe saying, hey, the ideas that are in that op-ed piece published in The Hill by RFK Jr. and Donald Trump Jr., we may not agree with those two people individually, but we agree with the concept of doing what's necessary to stop a war. It's not a surrender to Russia. Russia's not threatening to do anything other than make us listen to Rimsky-Korsakov music. Okay, that's what I had to do Friday night. I'm a rock and roll guy, but I went to listen because I wanted to send a signal that it's okay to listen to Russian music. It's okay to meet with the Russians. They're good people. It's okay to be humans with Russians. That's a future that we can all accept. It's not about Russia occupying us, dominating us, winning against us. They don't want that. They're not seeking that. They just want to live peacefully with us in an environment that says they appreciate who we are and we appreciate who they are. And there's no need for us to be killing one another. That's the world I want to live in.
Yeah. We've learned that we watched the interview that these two Russian pranksters did with Sikorsky. Did you watch it, Scott?
Did I watch what?
The interview that these two Russian pranksters did with Sikorsky.
Yeah, I mean, I've watched all their interviews. I've actually been on their show, and I've interviewed them myself on my podcast. These are remarkable individuals. They claim to be pranksters. I'm telling you right now, the impact that they have on informing the public about the truth that these people don't want them to see, they're having a better impact than the Russian intelligence service, which leads me to believe that maybe they're actually secret Russian intelligence services agents. And yeah, because they're doing amazing things. It's called a prank. But, you know, a prank is sort of harmless. What does Sikorsky say? I mean, he acknowledged that Nord Stream 2 was attacked, probably by the United States. He said that at a minimum, we knew about it. We did nothing to stop it. I mean, this is a dangerous, dangerous man, Sikorsky. And he's saying things right now that you have people in the Polish government that are talking about prosecuting him for violating the secrecy acts, that he was saying things that were classified. He thought he was talking to Poroshenko, his fellow, anti-Russian conspirator. He's talking to two Russian pranksters, but they weren't pranksters. These guys were exposing the truth. We can laugh about it. They did the same thing to Mike Pompeo. They've done it to just about everybody. And we can laugh about how clever, but listen to what they're exposing, the truths they're exposing. And you realize that we're being lied to 24/7 by our respective governments, whether it's the Polish government, the American government, the British government. They are incapable of trusting their citizens with the truth. Because if they were, then it wouldn't be the prank. Prank wouldn't work because they'd be finding out things that were already told to the general audience. Why is this important? Well, here in the United States, we have the U.S. government using the courts to attack free speech. I mean, they're coming after me. We just had a trial in Florida, the Uhura 3. One of the things that came out of that was the definition of disinformation. And that's an important term. You saw that Hillary Clinton used it in her interview with Rachel Maddow. We have to defeat misinformation. We have to defeat disinformation. And most people sit there and go, well, I mean, after all, shouldn't we support truth over lies? Sure. But what if the government's definition of disinformation has nothing to do with truth? What if the government's definition of disinformation is anything that deviates from the official narrative set forth by the government? And that's the definition that the U.S. courts embraced. Anything that deviates from the official narrative set forth by the U.S. government is disinformation. Just so you understand, let's put this in historical context. You were telling me before we went live that you saw an ABC interview about me in the lead up to the war and how I was saying that there was no weapons of mass destruction, et cetera. Truth, historical truth. We now know it. Even the people that didn't believe me then are saying, well, gotcha, you were right then. Okay, God, we'll give you that. That's disinformation. It's not the truth. See, I was guilty of disinformation. And if we had in place laws that said anybody who dares speak about, put out disinformation needs to be silenced, maybe criminally silenced, then the truths I was trying to tell to stop this war I wouldn't have been allowed to say it because it's disinformation. That's the danger that we're in right now. Free speech is under attack. I mean, just take a look at some of the insanity that's going on. Meta, the former Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, has now yielded to pressure from the U.S. government to silence RT. He shut down Instagram in India because of the because of the concerns that they were promoting a Russian pro-Russian narrative, and he's now shut down Russia on Meta on Facebook. I mean, this isn't free speech. You can say, well, I don't agree with the Russian narrative. Fine, don't agree with it. Come up with a better narrative. Come up with a better point of view. But once you start suppressing free speech, it's over. The constitutional republic we call America is finished. And it's not me saying that. John F. Kennedy warned about this in April of 1961 in a speech he gave before the American Press Association. He said that, I might not be happy with what you write, but you have every right to, not just a right to write it, you have a duty. You have a duty to hold me to account, to criticize me, because from criticism, better decisions are made. And yet today, we're not allowed to criticize. We're not allowed to question. We're not allowed to do our duty as American citizens. Now, I know there's a lot of foreigners out there that say, well, Scott, free speech, like in Russia, they say, well, we don't have free speech. You're Russia. That's okay. That's your business, not mine. China, I don't care. That's your business, not mine. America has free speech. It's one of the fundamental cornerstone rights we have as American citizens that helps define what this constitutional republic is. It helps make American democracy function. And when you remove free speech from this equation, we are no longer a constitutional republic. We are no longer the United States. We may call ourselves the United States, but we cease to function as the United States. And that's an outcome that I personally don't want to see. And so I think it's imperative that we allow all voices to be heard, that we respect ourselves and empower ourselves with the ability to discern between good argument and bad argument, sound facts and not so sound facts. It's a duty and responsibility that we all enjoy. And again, I just want to bring this full circle. We almost died this weekend. Why? Because many of us accept at face value the narrative being put forward by our government. And we view our efforts or anybody's efforts to challenge that narrative as not only counterproductive, but un-American. No, we almost died this last weekend because our government is promulgating policies based upon misperceptions, the deceptions of the threat posed by Russia. We almost died this weekend because our government is lying to us. We have a duty and responsibility to expose these lies and to challenge these lies and compel our government to either change its policies or elect people that are capable of changing those policies. It's not interference in the American election to challenge these policies. It's not disinformation. It's what every American is supposed to do. When you have people whom we've elected to higher office to represent us, we have to hold them to account. And you can't hold them to account if your voice is silenced.
And one of the points that Sir Sikorsky mentioned in this interview, he said that Ukraine can be part of the EU, but in the next 10, 20 years. I think, which was one of the reasons that in his visit to Kiev, he had some sort of serious disagreements with Zelensky, because Zelensky was talking about that Poland is not doing enough in favor of Ukraine to be part of the EU. And we've heard the same kind of rhetoric from the new foreign minister of Ukraine being part of the EU. Do you think in the current situation of this country, Ukraine, is that possible for the EU to let them in? And no. Just Poland is not agreeing on that?
No, Ukraine can't be a member of the EU. Ukraine will never be a member of the EU. I mean, the fact is, if the EU allowed Ukraine in, it would be the end of the EU. And it's just not going to happen. Ukraine doesn't meet any of the criteria required to be a member of the EU. It's totally incompatible. Every aspect of Ukraine is incompatible with the values that the EU claims that it embraces. It's economically, it's a wreck. It doesn't meet any of the economic requirements to be a member of the EU. Never will meet them. Ukraine's a destroyed nation. But this, again, this is part of the danger of this fantasy of Ukrainian membership in the EU, just like Ukrainian membership in NATO. I mean, you have, Biden, Ukraine will be a member of NATO. Blinken, Ukraine will be a member of NATO. Stoltenberg, Ukraine will be a, no, it's not. It never will be. Isn't going to happen. Forget about it. Forget about it. It's just fantasy. It's the kind of stupidity linked to bad policy that has to be promulgated because you can't admit that you've made a mistake. That's it. And as long as we allow Volodymyr Zelensky to parade around, in the form of the Ukrainian president, even though his term has expired, he has no legitimacy. He's being challenged not just by the Russians, but by his own party, opposition party, his own people are going to the court saying, get him out of there. He's not the president. He has no legitimacy. As long as we allow this guy to parade around and we wrap him with the mantle of legitimacy, we're going to have these kinds of discussions, which aren't conducive. Let's clear the air. Let's start off, imagine if we had a discussion where we said, Ukraine isn't going to be a member of the EU. Ukraine isn't going to be a member of NATO. And Ukraine has lost this war and isn't going to win this war. What are we going to do about it? Changes everything, doesn't it? Suddenly you're realistic and you go, well, we need to bring an end to this war and salvage what we can of Ukraine and I guess promote neutrality and see what we can do to rebuild Ukraine so that it can function as a neutral member of the broader European global community. Okay, now we're talking. Now we're talking. But as long as we put forward these absurdities, Ukraine's going to be a member of the EU. How? How? You can't articulate how that's going to happen. Ukraine's going to be a member of NATO. How? Russia will never allow that. Well, we're going to strategically defeat Russia. How are you going to do that without Russia destroying you with nuclear weapons? Well, I don't want to talk about that. We need to become real. We need to be very real about these, the facts. And the facts are Ukraine has lost this war. They're not going to win this war. They're never going to be a member of the EU. They're never going to be a member of NATO. You start with that, the solution starts to write itself.
When you look at the conflict so far in Ukraine, do you find the Kursk incursion as a turning point for the conflict?
A turning point occurred long before that. Kursk is just the last act. Look, the turning point of World War II, the war between between Nazi Germany and the Alliance, was the Battle of Kursk in 1943. At that point in time, Germany exhausted its strategic reserves. It had no ability to reconstitute these reserves, and the war was irretrievably lost. And yet Germany was able to launch an attack, the Battle of the Bulge, this offensive, in a desperate attempt to change the outcome of the battle on the Western Front. You can't call the Battle of the Bulge a turning point in the war. The war was already lost by the time that was fought. Kursk is not a turning point in the war. The last desperate act by a nation that has strategically lost this conflict. They committed their strategic reserves into this Kursk offensive. The offensive is stalled, and now the Ukrainians are being slaughtered, wiped out, annihilated. And in doing so, they made the war actually shorter. Just like, we don't know how much longer Germany could have survived if it didn't sacrifice thousands of tanks, a tremendous amount of ammunition, artillery, and manpower. What could they have done with a more mobile reserve on the Western Front to stop the deep penetrations? Could they have diverted that sum to slow down the Russian advance, in Prussia? Could they've extended the war into, instead of finishing in early May, could they have lasted another month, June? Could they have taken it to July? Could they have taken it to August? Probably. They still would have lost. They weren't going to win. But by expending those reserves, sacrificing on the battlefield, they made it impossible to hold on the East. Look at that movie Downfall, when Hitler's, where's Steiner? Let's move this army. Where's the Ninth Army? How come they're not doing this? Well, they didn't exist. What if they did exist? He still would have lost the battle, but he could have blocked. They could have done this. They could have evacuated. They could have done things. Those options were taken away because the strategic reserve was squandered in the Ardennes offensive. The Ukrainian strategic reserve squandered in the Kursk offensive. Now they've eliminated possibilities. Later on, Zelensky might be down in a bunker going, where's Sirsky? Where's this? Where's this? Where's that? They don't exist. Boss, you send them to Kursk and they're all dead. And we got nothing left and the Russians have broken through. That's the reality of what's going on right now. And unfortunately, I got to go in very soon.
Yeah, I'm going to wrap it up. Thank you so much, Scott, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.